Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Pass to Power, episode 18. I'm Matt Cooper.
And I'm Ivan Yates.
We have lots to talk about today, but we're going to start with the Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee. And the reason we're doing that is because she appeared in front of the Oireachtas Committee on Justice earlier this week. And when asked questions about immigration, I think it's fair to say she floundered. It was quite an extraordinary performance, almost like watching a car crash in slow motion politically. And it was very interesting, Ivan, for a couple of reasons. We'll get to the substance of it in a moment, but it did strike me. You WhatsApped me the video the other night. At the same time, I got it from two other people. This was suddenly doing the rounds. And it was a 5-minute clip that would not have appeared on TV news and didn't really get picked up initially by the newspapers. But in the social media era, Oireachtas TV was once famously, I think, described by Pat Rabbit as people for insomniacs to watch. But now what happens is there are people who are actually looking through it, taking out clips and sharing it on social media. And I thought the clip of about 5.5 minutes of her under pressure from Michael McNamara was devastating for her.
Yes. And he has legal training. He's a legal person. And just a little anecdote about Michael McNamara. I was about two years ago or whatever, walking along near Boswell's, and up behind me said, "Oh, you're the fellow who insulted me." And because he was a Labour TD and I predicted his going, and the phrase I used was, "Michael McNamara is very smart, but he's not as smart as Michael McNamara thinks he is." And he kind of stuck in his gullet ever since, but I've always liked him. But he was forensic in his approach with the minister. So they were discussing the new EU asylum pact. And what he forensically pursued was...
He went back into what's called Dublin 3, which is this prior arrangement whereby... And we're the first state in which a refugee arrives, and that's where they make their application to stay. And this has been pointed out by lots of people, is that given that there are no direct flights from Africa, from most countries in Africa or from Asia, how do these people arrive into Ireland? And Helen McEntee was asked a specific question by him in relation to 188 people who other countries were willing to take back and deal with their asylum application there. And he asked her how many of those 188 had actually been sent back to those countries.
And the answer was 3. And he asked a very basic question: where is the problem with her department when in the same year of 2023, Germany were able to send back 4,158 and France able to send back 3,311? And he said, what is the problem? Now, I've been that soldier. So the first thing you do is you explain the process. You explain why it's so difficult to send them back. You say how you maybe tried to send them back and so on. So you go into the technical default.
That's not what she did.
And the second thing you do, when that's not tenable, you actually... empathise with the questioner and say, Deputy, I share your concern about this issue and I'm not satisfied with this. Instead, she simply was completely out of her depth. She had no tackling an explanation for it. She tried to airbrush the question, which backfired on her.
Sorry, she made it worse because what she actually said twice was that, they don't want to take these people back. And he was able to point out, no, you're missing the point entirely. These are countries that said, give these applicants back to us and we will process them. So she actually has failed, I think, even since. She went on RT's News of One the following day, was unable to clarify it, hasn't done
as
so.
As a matter of fact.
But the other thing that really struck me about it as well was that she should have seen this coming. And the reason why she should have seen this coming was he wrote a piece for the Sunday Independent last week in which he outlined this and other questions in relation to the number of refugees who had been refused their asylum last year and who were still awaiting deportation. And she wasn't able to give a number as to how many of them had actually left the country. So those two key things that she floundered on inside the Oireachtas Committee had been highlighted by him in advance in a newspaper article. Now, I'm not expecting her to read all the newspaper articles at the weekend, but you would have thought, wouldn't you, that somebody in her department, one of her advisors, one of our press advisors particularly, would say, this is what you're likely to get, and here's the answer you should be giving. So what are they doing on her behalf?
So not only was that lamentable rabbit in the headlights out of her depth, Michael McDougall pursued her on the question of under the pact. So you're going to make a decision within 6 weeks, an appeal within 3 months, but what if someone goes to judicial review? And she answered the question as if he'd asked about appeals. She just didn't answer the question. She'd never thought of, well, a judicial review could take 2 years, you know, and the whole system could be paralysed. And then Marion Harkin asked her about, well, Denmark are not opting into this. She said, these are obvious questions that should be briefed on. But the point here is this. I said on this podcast that the first mistake Harris made was reappointing her. A, because he could not have a new, fresh law and order approach. But the argument that Francis Fitzgerald and other supporters of Helen put forward, that, you know, a new minister, the civil servants would run rings around them, they'd be exposed and so on. Like, at least a new minister would have the honeymoon of saying, well, look, I'm getting briefed on this. I share your concern, deputy. And you know what I mean? It's not acceptable. And we will have to get a system of deportation in place for the Dublin III agreement. And if we can't operate that, how can we operate future agreements? Like, even her tone was pathetic.
See, there are other things came up in relation as well. And the public account, or not the, was it the Public Accounts Committee? Maybe it was, actually, this week. One of the committees, anyway, heard that we're likely to get 20,000 people this year outside of Ukrainians who were applying under the International Protection Scheme, which is a much bigger number than anything we've had to deal with in previous years. So that then raises questions of, if these people go into the system, how long before their application is processed? And if they are rejected, how long before you have an appeal that lands on the minister's desk? And in the event of the appeal being rejected, when are these people deported from the country? And a few things came up here during the week as well. Not new, but worth re-emphasising because it's very important to the integrity of the process, particularly for those who believe that we should have international protection. So what happens is last year, 7,300 people around were rejected and told they're not allowed to stay. So what happens? The vast majority of them appeal. Very, very small number were actually ever deported, right? Which makes you wonder, well, what's happened with the rest of them? And Simon Harris was pushing the line as well in recent days in his defence of Helen McEntee that, well, it doesn't financially make sense to start going to the expense of deporting people. And sure, a lot of them will leave anyway. How do we know that they leave anyway? Where do they go to? If they've gone to all the trouble of coming to Ireland to try and seek asylum, why would they then just decide, well, we didn't get the formal application processed, we've been rejected, should we just go somewhere else? We don't know. That was one thing I thought was absolutely extraordinary. The second thing was Helen McEntee again said 80% of those who are coming for international protection, at least, are coming in over the border with Northern Ireland. How does she know that? How do they actually know? If they don't know what's happening with the people who are supposed to be deported, how can they be so precise with the numbers of those who are coming in, knowing how they come in?
Yeah, I've heard anecdotes of magic buses coming from the UK. And also...
That's a bit like those magic flights from Venezuela to the United States, like this, being put around by these activists.
Wouldn't it suit Britain to actually dump them. But actually, we have an agreement with Britain that if they come from the UK, we can send them back from whither they came to the UK. And apparently that's stuck in judicial review. But the Brits are prepared to, because of the common travel area, to take that. But on foot of that, I mean, like, I was reading, I had a briefing given to every backbench TD, Q&A, asylum pact and migration. And it asked all the question. And so if I was the minister, I'm putting myself in her shoes. The big question is, if we don't sign this, what'll happen? And it says quite explicitly here, we'll have no control and there'll be even more numbers coming here. That's the first line I would have used if I was her.
I'm sorry, there's a vote in the Dáil next week about this, and Sinn Féin now will be voting against it. Sinn Féin's position is interesting because it has now adopted a line straight out of the Tory playbook about open borders and taking back control of our borders, which is remarkable when you see it side by side with a lot of the Tory stuff in relation to Brexit, that Sinn Féin is using this line, made even more remarkable by the fact that its support of the government, I mean, it may not have cheered the government, it may not have applauded it, but it did support Leo Varadkar's government with Simon Coveney as Minister for Foreign Affairs in all the work it did in relation to a Brexit deal to make sure that the border on this island remained open. Quite correctly, what we needed. So if you're going to follow into the open borders rhetoric and taking control of our borders, would that not suggest that they want to close the border with the north to stop these refugees arriving in the country?
Well, I mean, the populist position is to be for less migration. Look at Newtown and Kennedy last night. These are very, very politically fraught circumstances. But arising out of this, I got onto some of my sources and say, you know, the separate issue of her not attending Westport, the GRA conference, and what is the issue in relation to her 4-year record, Helen McEntee, on policing. Now, to look at Drew Harris's culture, right? So you remember this American, Mr. Stephen Termani, at the end of July 2023.
Yeah, who was assaulted in Dublin City Centre.
Exactly,
viciously
assaulted. So at the time, he said that Reserve Gardaí would be deployed to undertake duties such as high visibility, patrolling, engagement and communities and policing of events. This was complete PR spin. There was no reality to it. There's a couple of hundred reservists. There was no money provided for their training, and it didn't happen. The same thing, when the road deaths went up, he said every cop would
half
do
an hour.
Half an hour. And it's a complete joke. So someone investigating a murder, a detective, the idea that it was just a complete gimmick. Overtime has gone up from 98 million to 140 million. And some of the anecdotes about the Biden visit are just unbelievable.
Can I just say on that, the guard? Some of the Gardaí I've been speaking to are happy enough to take the overtime, but they're not happy with the roster on the 6 days on, 4 days off. They find it exceptionally disruptive.
Friends at senior levels in the Guard, and I said, just explain to me about the Harris Garda culture and what the problem is. So words like despot, it's going from bad to worse. He got a 5-year term and a 2-year extension. But they quoted, like, so 98.4% of the GRA voted no confidence in him, the highest vote they ever had. So the first case that's quoted is this Athlone case of a bicycle that was impounded and was in guard things. And there was this old fella that a guard took pity on and they gave him the loan of the bike. He was not the right thing to do. This man was suspended for 3 years and he was pursued, shall we just say, very vigorously.
Now, he may have broken the rules and broken procedures, but the response was disproportionate to what had happened. I mean, like, you know, you have things like shotguns taken in 2009, which have gone missing. Now, that's what you'd expect a major investigation into, how something taken into Garda storage could end up back in the hands of criminals again subsequently, rather than a Garda giving a fella a loan of a bike and finding himself suspended for 3 years for doing so.
So the other cultural change is, shall we say, the Nordicization of the senior elements of the Gardaí.
Careful, though.
Well, it's a word like this. The fact is, in the senior leadership team of our An Garda Síochána, the National Security Service present, there are 4 out of 19 from the PSNI RUC. 5 if you add the replacement for John Barrett.
And what's wrong with that? They're all Irish as well,
Ivan. Well, put it like this. They have a different culture of a constabulary rather than a community-based police force that's unarmed, right? And in the Garda Inspectorate, there are 2 members from the RUC. But the most lethal case of all relates to Detective Garda Colm Horkin, who was killed.
In Mayo.
And this was in the 17th of June 2020. And he was murdered when an assailant disarmed him and fired 11 bullets into him and killed him. Right. Now, the situation is, and this is still to be fully exposed, the issue related to the holsters and whether these guns could be taken out properly. Apparently, the matter was disclosed to GSOC that there were safety concerns about these holsters. And the full story has not... People have told me that this is a scandal waiting to brew. And basically, what we have here is a situation that at senior levels and every level of the Gardaí, no one applied for the assistant commissioner job. People say that they don't feel they'll be supported if they... So say they take a decision on policing to strong-arm something or to that they will not be supported. They could end up being suspended, and everyone is looking over their backs and has made them lesser police persons.
OK, and this is why Helen McEntee, I think, made an enormous political mistake by boycotting the GRA conference this week. And that's effectively what she did. Because the GRA decided, on the back of the 98% vote of no confidence in Drew Harris, not to bring him to this conference, not to invite him to speak or to go to the dinner afterwards, which my understanding is unprecedented in the history of An Garda Síochána, that the commissioner would not be asked to the GRA conference. She lobbied that they rescind that decision and make the invite. They said no. So a number of weeks ago, she told the GRA she wasn't going either. Now, to give that level of support to Drew Harris in a situation where he is so badly at odds with his own rank and file is taking sides.
Mm.
She could have gone to that conference and she could have made the speech and she could have reprimanded them if need be, mm-hmm. and said, I believe it's wrong that you haven't asked the commissioner here. I wish you had. I'm going to listen to your complaints and your issues and the rest of it, and I will talk to him. But instead, she effectively took his side against them. And I can't see how that's good politics.
So the politics of this is Simon Harris had an opportunity to rebrand, refresh, reset the whole law and order thing, which he spoke about publicly from the get-go. He absolutely dropped the ball.
Sorry, when? Was this when he became Taoiseach or when?
In the reshuffle.
Oh yeah, because I'm sorry, he was Acting Minister for Justice for 6 months, which makes me wonder as well, what did he do in the job during the time when Helen McEntee was on maternity leave? That it may raise questions as to whether an Acting Minister actually performs the duties or is merely a placeholder waiting for the Minister to return. Because, you know, I'd be interested in asking him about this at some stage. In what did he actually do to advance things or to deal with things? Or was he feeling, we'll just wait until Helen McEntee comes back?
I heard that he was very hands-on. And I remember I was told this anecdote that in Phoenix Park headquarters of the Gardaí, there was absolute consternation when he comes alone and he rocks up at the door. And he wants to ask certain questions about certain things. This had never happened before. There was no forward planning or notice from the department officials and so on. And actually, people had a high regard for his period in that he got things moving. So, but like the essence of this is for the entire government, I don't know if you've noticed this, but very subtly, the spin the bottle has moved around the whole asylum issue. Is now no longer about Roderick O'Gorman.
No, and
it's about Helen McEntee.
And
this is a nightmare for Fine Gael.
But also a nightmare, isn't it? Because bizarrely, no matter how poorly she performs at present, and I think any objective analysis of her performance over the last week is that she has done poorly. And yet she's bulletproof. She is the minister for the remainder of this government because he missed his chance to move her out and put somebody else in.
So I think there's going to be developments on some of those Garda stories I told you about. And my prediction is that Drew Harris will not do the next 13 months as commissioner, and it'll be more collateral damage on her. Did I tell you about the planning story? Remember last week I entertained you, the book, you know, Who Owns Ireland?
Owns Ireland, thank you.
That fascinating property analysis of Ireland. But I have to tell you, because I have to, next Thursday I'm doing this infrastructure summit, and so I do Zoom calls with us. And I was speaking at length to Irish Water and Airgrid and all these good people. And so I told you about Hines putting 100 million into Clonliffe, and apparently the letter between On Board Planola and EPA, they didn't ask enough questions, and the whole thing, the religious heritage was the issue there. So I want to talk to you about, there's 1.7 million people living in the Greater Dublin area. And you know what? These people urinate and defecate every day. And so therefore we have to have wastewater and sewage facilities. And we are totally dependent on Ringsend at the moment. And actually the capacity of Ringsend has provided 30% more than they expected.
So we need a new plant in Clonshaw.
Yeah, exactly. So they have an orbital route of sewers that will all feed into Clonshaw. And this is an 8-year saga. And you could not make this up. So
next, it's in the book, Ivan. It's in the book.
well, put it like this. Well, I'll tell you my story first of all. What happened was, after this saga, that they had got consent, they had got the various permissions from the Custom House, and local objectors went to a High Court for a judicial review. And the good justices decided that in the correspondence between the EPA and On Board Planola, that they should have more rigorously asked about one particular topic that they didn't. It wasn't that On Board Planola or the EPA didn't approve it. So what happened was the court said, you may go back and start again and remit it back to the point where this correspondence had to commence again. And would you believe they did all that and they got that sorted out. And what happened? The time had run out for their permission with Board Planola, and they had to start the whole process all over again. So here the good people of Dublin are faced with a situation that the planning system has become so Byzantine, dysfunctional and everything else through judicial reviews that it just is incomprehensible. And we're going to wake up one morning and there'll be nowhere for the poo to go.
And the judges will find they're not able to flush their toilet.
Well, it couldn't happen to nicer people. But just go, tell me why I should not be going insane about this kind of stuff.
Who said you shouldn't be saying anything about this type of stuff?
I'm really saying it just is like, there has to be some sense of political and public will for things that are absolute national priority. You know, building a housing scheme in a particular area may not be a national priority, but providing wastewater treatment in Dublin and the Greater Dublin area is an absolute national priority.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, something else I want to switch to, and the Stardust inquest, and we had the ruling of unlawful killing in relation to that, and the 48 people who died in an absolute scandalous situation back in 1981, and even more scandalous that the families have had to wait 43 years for that finding of an unlawful killing to be made, and confirmation brought up about fire exits been chained and all the rest of it. And absolutely appalling. And an apology made by Simon Harris as Taoiseach on behalf of the state in the Dáil this week, which, judging by members of the families who I've spoken to since, that they appreciated, felt it was sincere and the rest of it. They're still very critical of some local politicians in particular for their failure to advance this over the years, in particular to Sean Haughey and Richard Bruton as long-standing TDs who they feel did less than enough, shall we say, to actually help them along the way. But the reason I bring that up is because there was a short... Well, it wasn't an apology. It was a very carefully crafted statement by Stephen Donnelly yesterday in relation to the Aoife Johnson inquest, which is what I want to talk about now. because we had this situation whereby this is one of the most shocking, terrible stories, I think, for any parent to actually imagine this happening to their child, that you would have a GP saying, we think your daughter has sepsis, get her immediately to an emergency department. She's brought to the emergency department. She's made wait to be triaged. When she is triaged, there's a further 15-hour wait before she gets seen by a doctor. And there is a delay in giving her the antibiotics, which most probably would have saved her, that this was a totally unnecessary loss of life. And we've had, over the last week at the inquest in Kilmallock, details of an appalling mismanagement of the situation at University Hospital Limerick, a complete lack of staff to cater for the numbers and whatever. So just here's the statement that Stephen Donnelly put out. I wish to offer my sincere condolences to Aoife Johnson's family and sister, to each of our parents and sisters who tragically lost their daughter and sister in University Hospital Limerick. I met with Aoife's parents in January. My thoughts are with them after what must have been an immensely difficult week. I would like to thank the coroner for all his work this week, but I'm aware that nothing would ever make up for the enormous loss the Johnson family has experienced. The coroner's recommendations will be fully considered, along with the work of retired Chief Justice Frank Clark, who was due to conclude his independent investigation in the coming weeks. Well, that's a carefully written statement, isn't it? Because that's not making any promises as to actually putting proper staffing levels in place to cope with University Hospital Limerick. Because quite clearly, with other hospitals in the area been downgraded, with this, I think, going back, I think, to the idea of Mary Harney in the past, centres of excellence and the rest of it, there's nothing excellent about the emergency department treatment which has been offered in University Hospital Limerick, because it wasn't just that day in 2022. This is a story that recurs, and every day we hear from the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation details of extraordinary numbers of people left on trolleys, left on corridors, not getting the treatment that they need to try and save their lives.
So, I've had some dealings with University Hospital Limerick and the management, Colette Cowan, and so on. And the truth of this story, and in terms of Stephen Donnelly, that Ennis's accident emergency department was closed in April 2009. Around the same time, Nina ED was closed, and St. John's Hospital in Limerick was also no longer taking patients in that way. And it's true to say, if you speak to the cohort on the kind of senior A&E people across the country, they actually believe at a trauma level there should only be one. If you get seriously ill, you should be taken by helicopter to this, you know, really tertiary place that was. And I remember before someone saying to me, Ivan, if you ever have a road accident that you're involved in, tell the ambulance in Arklow or Gorey when you're going to Dublin, going to the Dáil, do not stop at Loughlinstown, go straight on to Vincent's Hospital.
I've heard that said many okay. times. You need to go to a hospital. It's the same way that, for example, if you have a stroke, they said, if your family know, tell the ambulance to go to Beaumont in Dublin rather than going to Dublin, because that's where the specialist facilities and your best chance of recovery is. So I fully understand the rationale behind the closure of Ennis and the other downgrading of the other facilities, but that requires that you have sufficient capacity in Limerick and sufficient staff to operate the capacity.
So that's absolutely right. And what actually happened was they put the cart before the horse here, and they subsequently agreed that they needed to sort of treble the different nurses and consultants and all of that. And they have nearly completed one 96-bed unit and another 96-bed unit. So effectively 200 beds are needed. And a huge mistake was made in prematurely taking the people of Clare and the people at Tipperary and funneling them in the most, urgent sickness circumstances into that. And I honestly believe that the staff and so on were to some extent the fall guys for desperately bad planning and mismanagement of the issue. And that goes all the way to the top and goes back nearly 15 years.
How quickly can that be actually solved? Because one of the issues as well is that we have a rapidly growing population. We need all of these additional beds. And you know, this is one of the criticisms, I think, that should be made of government in over the last decade, so successive governments, an awful lot about plans and promises for doing things and for increasing capacity and a failure to deliver. Sometimes it comes back to the planning issues that you've mentioned for things like the wastewater facility and stuff. But a lot of the time, you know, we're told in prisons, it came up this week, right? It's got back to Helen McEntee.
Yeah, you always wanted another prison gone, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, they're now reconsidering Thornton Hall 20 years on. I've said it on this podcast in recent weeks. Yeah. An easy political win for the government would be to turn around and say, we now have massive overcrowding in our prisons. This came up at the Prison Officers Conference this week, that there are, and I know there are people who will not be sympathetic to the idea of people sleeping on mattresses and floors and bunk beds and cells and all the rest of it. But, you know, if you want to rehabilitate people who go into prison, you have to put the circumstances in place. And the numbers of assaults and violent incidents has rocketed because we simply do not have enough prison spaces. There has been a piecemeal approach to adding at the various other at the various prisons, which needs to be done. But on top of that, go ahead and build Thornton Hall. The political win in that as well. If they were to break ground, even if it's not obviously going to be ready in advance at the next general election, but if the foundations are in and the building's starting to go up, you'd be able to point to the government to point to that and say we're doing something in relation to crime. And it's the same with hospitals. You know, there's been talk of a new elective hospital in Cork. It's years behind schedule. There's been talk of one for Dublin, years behind schedule. It's all talk, talk, talk. We'll commit the money and nothing gets done.
Well, I can tell you, my good friends in Deeper, after what happened with the National Children's Hospital, they won't be ahead of the queue to finance a new hospital after the overrun and so on. Can I just an ironic, like what you said about the start is absolutely right. The families were treated and mistreated. How many times were inquiries rejected and so on? Just a completely an aside. So this was in January in 1981. And it was expected, the Fianna Fáil Ardéis was on that weekend of the fire.
It was February 81. It was the Valentine's weekend.
So it was expected that Haughey would announce the general election that day. And because of the Stardust fire, he put it back to an announcement in May, June. And would you believe it, I wouldn't have been a candidate in the 81 election because the convention would have been put back. There was an existing former senator who would have got the nomination, and I only actually got going in the months of February and March. So it's an ill wind.
But I have to say,
it's the next phase after the apology, whether there will be a redress scheme, whether there will be criminal proceedings. I think that'll bring real justice to the people, you know, representing the 48 families.
We won't preempt that. And the Garda, Drew Harris, as commissioner, has ordered an investigation of the files on the back of the findings of the inquest.
As a hard-working journalist, were you in the RDS last weekend for the Green annual conference?
I wasn't.
Right. Well, let's talk about it because
you?
No.
Would you be welcome?
No, I don't attend any conference because I've no need to. But the point is this, that I do observe these things. So we've taken a deep dive into Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and all the different parties. But I don't think we've given due attention to what are the prospects of the Green Party going forward. So we've well documented the ministerial performance of their front bench, Eamon Ryan, too big a portfolio, not able to deal with any of it.
Sorry, actually, when you look at the three cabinet ministers, they have something like 17 departments between them because of multiple portfolios that Eamon Ryan, Catherine Martin and Roderick O'Gorman have. And apparently the Fine Gael ministers have only six between them. So yeah, well, maybe you say bigger departments, but if you're trying to deal with things like, in Eamon Ryan's case, transport and environment and I can't even remember the list of stuff, but they're all separate departments that he's over.
So the point is this, one of his departments is DEC, Department of Energy and Climate Change. Where he has failed is to get, and as a party leader, this is particularly indictable, a whole of government approach. So in other words, you would think that the adherence to the climate action plans would be put in the planning bill. You would think it would be put in the county 31 county development plans. He has totally failed. You know, he's all these targets for renewable electricity, for public transport, for retrofitting, for EVs and so on. And none of them are going to be met by 2030. And so therefore, I think history is not going to be kind to him. that, you know, one of the things you need in government is follow through to actually say, this is what we're going to do, but then to be on the hot breath at the back of the neck every month on that. And he's failed to do that. He's more gone for the grandiose, big picture situation and making these announcements, but it's siloed thinking that hasn't penetrated the custom house. But the interesting thing is, if you look at the 12 green TDs, just to go into election sort of punditry territory, they are very much a Dublin-centric party. 8 of their 12 TDs are from Dublin. And so therefore, when you see the polls for, you know, 3%, 5%, what is their rating in Dublin? Because the rest of their seats are all city seats. And it is really oscillated between 3 and 10%. Now, there is a situation whereby they would all lose their seats if it was on 3%.
But if it was 10%, would they all keep their seats?
Well, put it like this, they would certainly would hold 5 of them, I would think. But the other thing that is one of the biggest drivers of this zeitgeist for the independents is the reaction to their anti-car agenda and their anti-agriculture agenda.
They're the easy whipping boys for the independents and the rest of it. I mean, I suppose most political parties in some respects resemble cults. And if you have, for example, you know, Sinn Féin have the belief in 32 County Ireland, totally understandable, respectable belief. People before profit are very much bought into this whole thing. Capitalism is evil and we must fight it down. The Greens, and they're very cultish in the way that they believe that environment is the predominant thing that dictates where politics should go. From what I saw of last weekend's party conference for the Greens, was there an element of that because they're so bought into the cult that they're a little bit delusional about their electoral prospects, that they think that because they're doing the right thing by the world, that everybody else is coming to understand them?
Well, I actually thought that was the most, I listened to Ryan's speech and so on, and I thought that was the most commendable thing. Like, I've a rule in politics, which is, if you don't like this set of principles I'm selling you, I'll give you another set of principles. In other words, whatever the public wants, the public get.
You're a Marxist. And you get both. A Groucho Marxist.
Exactly. But the Greens have actually said, you know, this is what we're going to live or die by. And they go through this cycle. You remember with Roger the Rabbit in South Dublin, where they go from from 12 seats to one seat, back to 12 seats. And that cycle, I think, is set to continue. But I think it is nice that they were basically saying, and I think it's, sorry, applaudable, that you may disown us, you may disagree with this, you maybe don't like the consequences of what we're doing in terms of emissions and all the impact it has on your home, on your life, and on your business. But you know what? We believe it's the right thing and we're sticking to it, because my philosophy is exactly the opposite. And I think that's kind of commendable.
I think actually the European and local elections may be very indicative of where they're going to stand for the general elections, perhaps more so than for any other party. Because if you remember back to the last local elections, the likes of Hazel Chew got an enormous vote in her ward for Dublin City Council. How well will she do now when it comes to the local elections?
But she's kind of fell out with them. You know, she's had her problems.
She's still very much seen as a Green.
Yeah.
And we'll see, because she's in Eamon Ryan's constituency. Yeah. So we'll see how well she does in the local elections as a potential bellwether for how well he will do in the general election.
We'll put it like this. I actually have been researching Grace O'Sullivan, because I would have her. She's from Waterford. She'd be first on the list to say on a bad day for the Greens she's going to go. But a number of people in Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael said to me, don't underestimate Grace O'Sullivan, that she's quite savvy. She's got a track record. She's built her own network, and that she could survive a tide against the Green Party.
And then Ciarán Cuff is their other MEP in Dublin.
Who's quite active. Like, I actually was at a conference where he presented on the new performance of energy directive on buildings. And my God, I told him he had only 15 minutes. He was absolutely passionate about it and had negotiated nearly every paragraph of it. I put it like this, you know, he was a former minister, he was a TD, had a high profile. I actually think he has a chance of getting a seat.
Okay, there's going to be an enormous amount of high profile people contesting the seats in each constituency. We're getting more and more people coming forward, more of what we might call loosely celebrity candidates. Mm. I mean, like, we've now got Niall Boylan, for example, joining in.
Well, I wouldn't be too derisory about Niall
Who
Boylan.
Who said I was being derisory?
Well, just your tone sounded a little bit. I was insinuating that, you know, you were urinating on him there. But like, the point about it is this, and I remember when he appeared regularly on The Tonight Show.
Too regularly.
I actually think he was in favour of Brexit. I could be wrong about that, but he always took contrarian views on everything.
For the sake of it. I mean,
That's what a shock jock does, because I know.
He's the shock jock candidate.
He is the shock jock. And look, you know, the way to dismiss him is say, this election is about solutions, not soundbites. But I would say that, like, in terms, you know, I always admire opportunism. As opportunism goes, this is class A insofar as...
Oh, well, hang on. He's had to give up his radio show, which would suggest that if he doesn't win...
There is more to life than being a DJ.
I
mean, anyway,
I would say he's not a DJ. So he loses that income if he doesn't get elected as an MEP. Although I suspect what he'd probably be quite confident is that a few months down the line, he'd be reinstated to his job in the radio station.
Well, the point about it is this. He will certainly be a disruptor candidate. He certainly will eat, I think, that right-wing vote in a way that right-wing candidates, you know, really strong right-wing candidates won't. I think he could hit Sinn Féin hard. I think he'd be very good on sound bites. He'd be pugnacious. He'd be very good on social media and X and Twitter and all of that. I actually would not be dismissing the prospects he could get elected.
I didn't dismiss the prospects that he might get elected.
But you seem depaled.
Whether he should be elected is another issue. But I wonder, will there be confusion caused as well? Because he'd be one of two Boylans.
Lynn. I did think that too.
And Lynn, actually, very interesting.
I would be predicting she'll top the poll.
Well, I think so, because Lynn Boylan was a very impressive MEP when she was in there previously.
And she comes across as a very sort of likable type of amenable. She's not a hectoring person.
Here's the interesting thing. I mean, I thought she was very unfortunate to lose her seat the last time around. I think it came as a considerable shock to her. But she is very strong in environmental issues. I mean, in many respects, she's very close to the Green Party in an awful lot of her thinking. But she was at a conference this week and she did make comments about how environmental issues didn't matter to a lot of Sinn Féin voters, that they were more interested in bread and butter issues. And when you read past the headline, a lot of what she said actually made an awful lot of sense. But it did again come across as yet another area where Sinn Féin are stepping back from the position that they had taken and say, well, the environment stuff is no longer as important to us because they're afraid perhaps have been seen.
I told you there's only one thing they care about, a border poll within 5 years.
Well, absolutely.
Socialism, sustainability, all can be negotiated away.
But everything that they've taken a strong position on in recent years, to their credit, in my view, right? Yeah. Things like that, they have been very strongly anti-racist, and you can see lots of times when they've been out protesting on behalf of refugees. They had took a position on the hate crime bill, which they have now done a complete U-turn on, despite the fact that they were saying only a year ago how important it was to get this through the Dáil. And now, as I said earlier, they've gone to this open borders position, which closely resembles Tory speaking. So it does all come to that point. They will do whatever it has to be done to get as many votes as possible to get into government, to get to that one objective, which is the border poll, despite the fact that many people who will vote for them will be doing so on the basis that they will be hopeful that they can sort out housing or sort out health. Those are all secondary to that bigger picture. So even the survival of the world is less important than a united Ireland is.
As well as Niall Boylan, who I think can get a protest vote and should not be underestimated in terms of working class areas and the kind of mood of the moment of sort of visceral, toxic feelings about establishment politicians. The other person who I think has done his prospects no harm or has thrown his head in there is Michael McNamara himself in Clare.
Is there not going to be a reaction to the idea of these people wanting to jump out of the Dáil to go into the European Parliament?
No, the experience is, like, if you go back to 1985 with the PDs, the day the PDs formally launched, The next poll had them at 34%. 6 months later, they were down to 15%. Now, that was at a time when people had considered political opinions. Now people have political opinions that have a shelf life, you know, equivalent to a goldfish.
Yourself.
No, I have my principles,
and if you don't like them, I have other principles.
I'm talking about winning. But what I'm saying there is that someone like Michael McNamara could put aside the best laid plans of all the parties and strategies by actually timing it late to enter the field, that you have more impact at that stage.
Okay. Well, we leave it there.
Those by-elections will never be held if those TDs make it. Because we now have firmed up, it'll definitely be the 15th of November is the general election.
Oh, God, you're back. Because you listened to me last week and I told you it couldn't be the 8th of November because of the Rugby International.
I'm actually
you went back
budget,
to your sources, did you?
The budget will be the 2nd of October. The Dáil will be...
No, 7th of October, isn't it?
No, it's already down for the... It's already down for the 7th, but they're going to do it a week earlier on Wednesday the 2nd. And the Dáil will be dissolved no later than the 22nd of October. So I don't know how that affects the most important issue at the time of the day, which is your goddamn visit to Washington.
I can take 3 days in New York. There's no point in going to Washington to cover the general or the presidential election.
I'll take your
election.
Word for it. Another junket from Matt Cooper.
No. It's all work, Ivan. It's all work. And that is the last of what we're going to talk about today on Path to the Power. Don't forget to get in touch with your emails. We are monitoring them. We're reading them. They're really interesting. And we will do another
Matt
constituency
anyway.
Clinic special when we will do another one. So the email address is mail@pathtopowerpodcast.com. So that's mail@pathtopowerpodcast.com. Don't forget, please, to recommend us to a friend. We can be heard on Apple or Spotify or even YouTube. You can don't have to watch us on YouTube. You can just put the sound on instead of having to look at us. But there are loads of ways to get us. And please subscribe. It doesn't cost you anything to subscribe and recommend to a friend. And then we'll be back again next week. So from me, Matt Cooper.
And from me, Ivan Yates.
Thank you for joining us.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. Warbyparker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.